When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to another Pole Position. We're very, very excited. I'm always excited when it comes down to Polish history, only because I am learning something new. I'm always learning something new. And yeah, we have not got 20th century history today. Sorry to my 20th century history friends, apologies, but you are going to learn something new, something really interesting. And this is not going to be the first podcast, so bear with me, I'll explain what I'm talking about. Let me introduce my first guest today. So we've got Dariusz von Guttner-Spożyński. He is a medieval historian and a lecturer at Melbourne University. He has written books like Poland, Holy War and the Piast Monarchy, 1100 to 1230, and Writing History in Medieval Poland, Bishop Vicentius of Kraków, and the Chronica Polon. I can't even pronounce this last one. Dariusz, can you pronounce this last one for me?
Chronica Polonorum.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Again, Latin, can't do Latin. So welcome to our podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
We are really interested because this is not going to be just one podcast, because we're going to be looking at the Piast dynasty, the monarchy, however you want to pronounce it. We're going to be doing this into a three-part series because I think these guys deserve so much more attention than in one 40-minute podcast. Don't you agree?
Well, we can be speaking for hours about Piasts and generally about early Polish history. We may not know too much detail, but it is a pretty fascinating period in history. And from what is there, we can make it, many episodes.
I love it. I think we should do this. Right. Okay. Because this all starts with a Western Slav tribe of Polania. So can you tell us about them? Who were they and why are they so important?
Look, the question is, we don't actually know the exact names of these people, other than in the sources in the 9th century, in the written sources, we get the kind of a corruption of the word Polania. So this is one of the tribes, of the Western Slavic tribes, that that became prominent. Prominent and perhaps one of led by quite forceful and ruthless leaders, they managed to consolidate the territory and clearly ruled over a number of people. We don't know numerically how large the tribe was and how large the territory originally was. But Western Slavs, they are people, you can say generally, people of today's Poland and Eastern Germany. This is when we have the Western Slavs. Western Slavs also include Czechs. So these, the Slavs in, how would you say it, on the west side of the Oder, the river, they are no longer a political or national entity as such. There are some of the communities still in existence, Sorbs, for example. But Western Slavs dominated this area, you would say, between Berlin and Warsaw. I think you can generalize that's where the Western Slavic tribes were based. And one of the most prominent of those is or was the tribe of Polania. Polania, the name that we have in Latin sources, in variants of Polania, Polans, Poloni. That's what the ninth century sources tell us about them. We don't really know where they came from, whether they were based in the region between Berlin and Warsaw, for example. And of course, I need to remind us that neither Warsaw nor Berlin are in existence at the time. But just to bring it to the modern context, we don't know whether they originated from that particular place, whether they migrated. There are various theories. Theories of conquest, theories of migration, we simply don't know. What we know that in the 9th century they appear in Western European written sources as an already political entities in existence, kind of a proto-nations, a little nations in making.
I've got to
So that's
say,
how.
this is so interesting because we all talk about identity, especially now, because Polish identity now is so complex. It is not as simple as people from the outside seem to think. But this is even more complicated. So Poles, parts Polania, are coming from between the modern context, Berlin and Warsaw, and now the country is so different.
Well, yes, we in a way, this is the perception that Adam Zamoyski's pointed to in one of his books when he said that very often foreigners imagine or live with the stereotypes that Polish borders really shifted that much. But if you look at examples of France or Germany or Austria or even Bohemia, Czech Republic today, their borders shifted quite as much as the Polish borders did. So if we take this Western Slav groupings of various tribal groups, families, we have the Western Slavs, the Sorbs, for example, and then we have Western Slavs, Poles across both sides of the Oder River. They are the main ones. Yet we know that Czech. The Czech that evolve later on from the same Western Slavic groupings, they share linguistic affinity. And this is perhaps what we had at the time of the very early Piasts, that people from the Czechs, the Sorbs, and the Poles can communicate relatively easy. That's why perhaps in Polish, when you talk about a German person, they couldn't communicate with a person speaking German because, and they call them Niemce, those dumb ones with whom we cannot communicate. This is the first kind of idea of that identity of us and them, the other, those with whom we do not share common tongue.
Oh, now I know what Niemce actually means. So Niemce in Polish is Germany, and that comes from that far back in history.
Yes. The dumb ones, those that don't speak our language. Yes.
I'm so sorry, guys. So let's talk about the Piast dynasty. First of all, where do they get their name? Because there is a legend. So can you tell us about this legend, and is there any truth in this legend?
Look, what can we say about legend? Legends have a tendency of having something real to start them off. So even if you think about the names of the nations, Poles, the Russians or the Rus, and the Czechs, I think you refer to the legends, legend that talks about three brothers that were traveling together. It almost sounds like a Harry Potter story, you know, three brothers traveling through the bridge and they encounter a meeting, you know, where there's a meeting with death. But I think in the legend, in that kind of legend of the Lech, Czech, and Rus, there is no death that they meet, but they kind of give they give beginning to their own nations. So the Lech becomes the progenitor of the Poles, the Czech, you know, becomes the ancestor of the Czechs, and the Rus becomes the progenitor of Russians, you can say. The legend, I think there are different derivatives of that legend. It's essentially the one where the national symbol of the Poles is prominently displayed. You know, the eagle's nest and the eagle that Lech spots and decides that this is going to be the place where he is going to set his home, and this is where he's going to settle. This is quite a, you know, quite a curious legend that most likely comes from much later sources. And in a way, it's not linked to the name Piast at all. There's Lech, and the, you know, the way later we use the name Lechici sometimes in Polish for to talk about the Poles instead of Polania. Piast is not related to any of these legends, unfortunately. Piast is coming into being much later, and perhaps relates to a word piastować, you know, to hold an office, or to like piastunka, the person that takes care of a baby, someone that holds the baby and nurses the baby. This is this kind of word. Now, it probably comes as late as the 15th century when Polish writers, Polish historians, history writers, or chroniclers are coming to give names to those ancient rulers, to those original holders of the highest office in the land. And they come perhaps with the legend of the Piast. And they come with the story of, and there, of course, we have different stories of who Piast was, and including the one story about popiel and mice. But Piast seemed to be that word that is referring to a cradle, to something that is the beginning. And it's a funny kind of name. We don't encounter it in any early documents. Mieszko the First, the one that we know as the first ruler of the Poles that we have solid records about, we know that he doesn't call himself, "Oh, I'm a Piast dynast," or "I'm the head of the Piast dynasty." So the name of Piast is very much given to the dynasty, to the first historical Polish dynasty, much later on.
So we're going to talk about Mieszko, who is the first ruler of Poland. We're also going to talk about his son Bolesław. So those are the two that we're going to be talking about in this podcast. But I'm going to embarrass myself here. So over the summer, I spent some time teaching English to children, and they asked me to do a history quiz. Now, of course, the modern historian can do anything from modern history, decides to go into Google and misread everything about Mieszko the first, because you got to remember, I did this at Polish school when I was like 13 or 12, and that's been a long time. And genius here decided to put down that who was the first king of Poland? Mieszko the first. So cue the laughter, everybody. So yes, Mieszko was a ruler, not a king. I will forever have that burnt into my memory. So he's the first ruler that, well, he converts Poland and himself to Christianity. But do we know anything about his early life at all?
Not really. No, we don't. There are perhaps three sources that are very, very brief. One is Dietmar Meseberg, who kind of writes a little bit about this, about the baptism and conversion of Poland. Perhaps we have some accounts from Gallus or from anonymous author who conventionally is called Gallus, although that name is challenged quite recently. And then we have Bishop Vincentius of Kraków, or otherwise known as Wincenty Kadłubek in Poland. What we know about Mieszko from those early sources is that, one, that he is recognized as the overlord of those tribes known as Polania, that his kingdom is quite, he's referred to by some travelers from as far as Spain as the ruler of the north. He clearly is a quite powerful warlord. Perhaps that's why the prince or a king or a duke, it's very much coming from Latin. And it's, you know, did Western Slavs refer to their leaders as dukes or princes or kings? Perhaps not. But we know he is on the top. He's the head of that particular political unit. And he appears there already in the middle of the 9th century. Sorry, 10th century, as a person of note, as a person that empire is already looking to keep order In those borderlands between the territories that he rules, so let's say approximately modern Western Poland, and territories that Empire is attempting to conquer. So when the first information about him is the one that he's engaging in some battles with some German rebels, that he's quite a good warrior, that he command troops that are successful in defending their own homeland, and that they are very successful in attacking others and subjugating tribes to west of their domain. So when we encounter information about Mieszko and his baptism, there are different versions of it, and versions that suggest that he reached out to the Czechs to ask them for information about this new religion that was so powerful, so predominant in Western Europe. There is another version that first he got married to Dobrava of Bohemia, to daughter of the Prince of the Czechs, and she taught him and, in fact, instructed him about what were the principles of this new religion that was coming from the West. There is another another suggestion that he cemented his alliance with the leader of the Czechs by marrying his daughter and at the same time agreeing that he's going to become a Christian. So there's quite a lot of things that we don't know, because there is no we don't have precise written sources, precise information about what was the chronology of these events. What we know, and what we, I guess, Polish historians are arguing for quite some time, the date of 966 being the year when we agree that Mieszko was baptized. And some of the chroniclers straight away assume that his baptism brought all of his subjects into Christianity. I guess historians doubt this. The suggestion is that when Mieszko accepted baptism and became Christian, that some of his immediate court perhaps accepted Christianity, but there is nothing to suggest that anyone else in Poland immediately accepted Christianity. In fact, if we think about the customs, that kind of a lot of pagan customs were surviving, well into the 12th century, you would say.
There is another theory, though, but we are going to cover that a little bit later, just to add another theory into the mix for fun, because we can. Sticking to, well, it is a bit about Christianity, but he marries the Czech princess. How much do we know about this marriage?
Well, we know that it happened probably in 965. So we that this is perhaps the information that is more certain, because it is passed to us through Polish annals. So the very ancient kind of recordings of just single events with the yearly dates. So 965, we know that Dobrava arrived at Mieszko's court. There are various kind of suggestions that she was perhaps an older woman, as some of the German chroniclers suggest. What we know that the marriage happens at that time. We also know that Mieszko's conversion happens later on. So in a way, the role of the wife here perhaps is quite significant. She brings him around to Christianity. And later we know that in 967, their son Bolesław is born. This is perhaps all that we know of the marriage. He Mieszko, according to the pagan Slavic tradition, most likely had numerous wives, and I think all the early chroniclers are suggesting that Mieszko was convinced by Dobrava on her arrival at Polish court that he should renounce those pagan wives. And I think the number was given as six wives in one of the accounts, that he should renounce those wives and only then she would marry him. And together, when they were married, he will then accept baptism and initiate the Christianization of his subjects.
She must have been some woman to lay down those laws.
I suspect, like other famous women in history of the Poles, like Riheza of wife of Mieszko's namesake, Mieszko II, like Królowa Jadwiga, like Elżbieta Habsburżanka, like Bona Sforza d'Aragona, for example. Or like Marysieńka, those famous wives of Polish monarchs, or like Anna Jagiellonka, for example, the queen that is elected king, and the same with Jadwiga. So there are famous women that were strong persuaders, you can say, and Dobrawa perhaps is the first that we know in sources, the first that is kind of historically based in time, princess who becomes a spouse of the Polish ruler that clearly exerts an enormous amount of authority that brings him over to Christianity and then gives the beginning to the Piast dynasty as such.
I kind of wish we knew more about her because she seems like a real badass.
Difficult to say. Look, if the chroniclers are correct, and if she arrives, and then there are lovely six wives standing there on the side, I don't think she would be particularly happy about this, given that Dobrawa is already Christian. She already has lives within certain different set of principles. The marriage was between men and a woman, but it was a just one-on-one marriage. It was not one with six or seven wives. It didn't work that way. So I suspect it might have been a little bit of a cultural shock. But if she was surprised, she clearly worked very, very hard on Mieszko to make sure that she became the only Christian wife and the only wife in practice.
So apart from badass women that we love on this podcast, clearly, we love a bit of Vikings because they come and play a role in this narrative, don't they? What happens with the Vikings?
Oh, look what happens with the Vikings. It seems that Vikings are almost like Poles. They always feature in whenever you talk about European history. It seems to be that Poland is somehow involved. Now, somehow Vikings are involved in everything too. Later on, Mongols would be involved in everything. The Viking connection, there are different theories as well about relationship or intermarriages between the Piasts, the dynasty that Mieszko is representing in the 10th century, and the Vikings. There is a theory that perhaps his daughter is so-called Świętosława or Sigrid the Haughty, a Scandinavian queen that later gives birth to Canute the Great. So you've got a further kind of complication of history. It seems that archaeology suggests to us that Vikings were very much present in the territories under Piast control. There are various traces of their presence. And look, could it be that it is like another story of the Vikings, the TV series? That Piasts are in fact, like in Rus, the Piasts are in fact some sort of an offshoot of a Viking warlord who settled in the territory and gave beginning to the Piast dynasty. Of course, look, this is the theory that Polish historians no longer like. It was popular at some time. It's kind of no longer accepted as a viable theory. Again, hypothesis, very much theory with just wishful thinking, and if you have a lot of fantasy, I think that would work. I mean, the Vikings TV series are in what, six series now?
I think so. I mean, I've not watched it, and now you're talking about this, I might have to start watching. Do they show the Polish nation in it?
No, I don't think they do. I don't think they do. I haven't seen the sixth series. They're just about to open in Australia in a couple of weeks. But I think it's a pretty realistic, if a little bit fantastic, way of showing Vikings as being not this kind of homogeneous group of Scandinavian warriors, but as quite complex society, very much human, very much living on the edge of world with curiosity and with quite a pride and this kind of push to know more. So brilliant TV series.
I'm going to have to start watching it, I think, because it keeps coming up on my Netflix saying, watch me. And I'm like, no, but I want to stick to modern. It's far more interesting. But you might be tempting me to the dark side.
Why not? It's a pretty dark side, yes. It's all, sex, drugs, rock and roll.
In the ancient time, well, ancient, gosh, in the medieval times.
Early medieval times, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so, well, at this point, Mieszko does expand his empire, doesn't he? I mean, how does he end up doing that?
There are, again, we are subject to a lot of theories by a number of historians, some more prominent than others. That original stronghold that Polania hold is perhaps around Poznań in Wielkopolska, so Greater Poland for us. That we don't actually know that where the actual capital city is based. Traditionally, Poznań gets quite a good write-up in this, but there is a theory that perhaps city of Giech was the center of Mieszko's state. But that state, and I guess state in English sounds a little bit, it's not appropriate, but the realm of Polania under Mieszko's command extends all the way to through Wielkopolska towards modern Warsaw and towards Mazovia that way, and then towards Silesia, Śląsk. But Silesia is not part of it, so it is very small. A small realm. And it looks that early Poles are very much organized as a very good offensive force. So Mieszko, together with his warriors, is able to subjugate his northern neighbors. Perhaps we would refer to them Pomeranians today, the Western Slavs that lived along the sea, Pomeranians. Then Mieszko moves to against Mazovians and brings them in under his control. He then perhaps goes as far as almost modern borders of Poland, where Lublin is, and the one of the tribes there is called Lenjania. So that goes goes pretty far east in that respect. Then at some point, perhaps not long before Mieszko's death in 992, the lands of Kraków are incorporated into his realm, and perhaps at the same time, beyond the Oder River, he reaches out to conquer Śląsk. So Silesia becomes part of his realm. If you look at the map, that border, of course, look, this is very much hypothetical, but the expansion very much matches the modern Polish border as such. Again, this expansion is based on a quite well-organized strategic war machine based on not mercenaries as such. We don't know that much about mercenaries, but about the warriors that under command of Piast leaders are able to quite quickly overcome opposition from those tribes to the north, to the east, and to the south. And in that way, this kind of basic, you would say, Poland is built by the end of Mieszko's life in 992.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I have a very strange question. So at the moment you're referring to like Silesians, Mazovians. Is that what the tribes were called at the time?
Look, we don't actually know exact names of those people as such. We have some records which give us description of Mieszko's realm. And in those accounts, there are names of the bordering tribes. So, for example, the Pomeranians, the Prussians are listed there, the Mazovians, Lenjania, the people inhabiting Kraków, or they are referred to as Krakow, and then Silesians. So we've got those first Latin attempts to give the sounds of what locals were saying when they were talking about themselves, and then transcribing Latin script. So you can say, yes, those names that kind of corrupted exist today were already in usage at the time. And I guess my suggestion is that that those Latin scribes try to record the sounds that they heard about, you know, what is the tribe? It's Polania. What is the tribe? Silesians. That they captured sounds of those names that way.
That is so interesting. That I love that. I'm actually going to use this now when I talk to people about Polish history. So I really want to thank you. This is some seriously amazing content about the early Polish nation, kingdom, lands, whichever word you want to use, take your pick, anybody. Let's stick just a little bit longer with Mieszko. So some people say he was a brutal and ruthless ruler. Obviously, how much do we know into that?
Well, this is the accounts of his reign are very, very limited. There is some information coming from Ibrahim Ibn Yaqub, who is a Jewish trader from Spain, and who gives a description of Mieszko's realm, but in quite positive terms. Mieszko is presented there as a generous and caring ruler, the person who provides for his warriors, and for the families of those warriors. The master of that state, of the realm, that is taking care of the needs of his subjects. An example about taxation, for example, and clearly it's also a person that is reported to be taking care of, and this is coming from Christian sources, of course, spiritual. So the propagation of what's the better word? Christianization of his people. So cruel, I don't know. The sources seem to suggest that he clearly must have been quite a good strategist and a warrior himself, that he was able to consolidate and push other tribes to accept his rule. I mean, you don't achieve this just by going and speaking to those people. Back in those days, life was pretty brutal. And I imagine that what Mieszko and his army did, they were quite brutal to bring Pomeranians or Prussians or Mazovians or Silesians under their rule. On the other hand, as I said, accounts from those travelers give a picture of a generous and thoughtful and you would say a good good master to his people.
Okay, we're going to move on to Mieszko's son, Bolesław. Just so everybody knows, this is the first king of Poland. This is the mistake that I made. Instead of Mieszko, it is Bolesław. But we're going to get to that stage in a minute. So he has a son, Bolesław. He is Mieszko's heir. Do we know anything about... Please tell me we know something about his early life.
About Mieszko? No, we don't really know that much.
Bolesław's early life.
Bolesław, we don't know that much other than clearly he is brought up in the spirit of the conquests of his father, at the same time that he must be clearly a quite skillful and strong ruler. Because in fact, he consolidates the achievements of his father, he's able to further extend the territory of his kingdom. And we're talking about kingdom, his crown shortly before his death in 1025. But he expands the kingdom in different direction. The legend tells us that he goes as far as Kiev in one of his expeditions in the early 11th century, that he settles a lot of things with the Czechs, that he goes against other Western Slavs in the West, against the Sorbs and others, that he then hosts the Congress of Gniezno, where the emperor, the Roman emperor, arrives in Poland and is greeted and hosted in Gniezno and Poznań by Bolesław himself. And that's a sign of Bolesław's stature. It's also a recognition, perhaps, of that the territories of the Piasts are seen now as being quite extensive and therefore unnoticed by the rulers of the German Empire. And Otto the First, young and very idealistic emperor, seemed to be recognizing, and this is the voice that we hear in Polish chronicles, recognizes Bolesław as his co-builder of this universal imperial vision of Christian Europe and harmony and living, you would say, in Christian kind of peace. Otto the Third is very much, he's very enthusiastic about bringing Poland and Bolesław's realm into that universal empire vision, and in a way to settle differences between perhaps the Germans advancing east and the Poles defending themselves on slightly different bases, not just the violence, not just perpetual war. Of course, this situation changes after Otto the Third dies. So Bolesław, perhaps wise, perhaps one of the Polish kings deserves the appellation the Great, chrobry, referring to his valiant or the brave nature of the king, but perhaps also referred to as Bolesław the Great, one of those dukes that managed to secure his coronation and the one that becomes King of Poland in 1025.
So does he get married at all? And does he have any children? I mean, I'm assuming he does, considering the Piast dynasty carries on.
Oh, goodness. He's not quite Henry VIII in terms of wives, but almost there. It's possible that there are at least four wives, that there is and again, we don't know much about the first of his wives. There is a suggestion that perhaps it was a princess or a daughter of a warlord somewhere from the West, but West in a sense of Slavic West. We know that perhaps second wife is a princess from Hungary. Then we know that one of his favorite wives is Milda of Lusatia, so another Western Slavic nation. And the final is Oda from Meissen, that is the final wife, and the one that features later on in various dramas of the Piast dynasty. And from those four wives, we know that Bolesław Chrobry has a number of children. The eldest is called Bezprym, but it is Mieszko II, his son from Emnilda of Lusatia, that he is chosen to be the heir and successors of Mieszko of Bolesław. Goodness, we're only on to second Mieszko, and I'm kind of now being confused. Mieszko the First, Bolesław Chrobry, and now Mieszko the Second.
It's a bit like when we talk about England in the medieval period. You've got your Henry, your Matilda, your Mary, and is that Mary? Which Mary? That Mary? Oh, that Mary. That, right, okay.
So yes, family trees and those relationships quite important. You see, it's Bolesław Chrobry seemed to be one of those very charismatic rulers of whom both the anonymous known as Gallus and Bishop Vincentius of Krakow write extensively. He is the one that seemed to be setting the tone for all other rulers. Polish leader, Polish ruler needs to be a crowned king. He is equal to the emperors because emperors treat him as equal. He is part of this big Christian family of crowned rulers. He is the Rex, Latin for king. It is very interesting kind of a concept that Bolesław sets the tone for all other Polish kings, and every of those kings in the Piast dynasty will try to be like that ancestor of theirs, Bolesław Chrobry.
He set the bar really, really high.
Yep, he did.
Okay, so we've touched already on this about his dedication to Christianity, but who was more dedicated, him or his father?
Good question. Can we really judge it in this way? Can we really talk along this? You know, Mieszko definitely is credited with accepting Christianity for himself, accepting baptism, and then taking the first steps to introduce Christianity to his subjects. Bolesław takes it further, and perhaps this is incremental. Bolesław is already brought up as a Christian. Bolesław is supporting, for example, Christian missions, one of the very famous missions of Bishop Adalbert of Prague in 997, the mission that gets Adalbert killed by the Prussians, and that brings the first Polish saint, the first Polish saint patron, whose body then is retrieved from the Prussians by Bolesław and placed in a shrine in Gniezno. So, look, it's very difficult to say whether you can put the kind of a value, whether Mieszko Bolesław is more Christian or more religious or more adept at following the Christian church. Certainly both of them made those first steps towards Christianizing their subjects. And by no means during the reign of Bolesław the First, there is no suggestion that all of the Poles, all the subjects, all his subjects were Christianized. We understand that perhaps the court elites and leaders of in different provinces were very much accepting Christianity and moving towards building Christian churches and cathedrals and establishing a new kind of ecclesiastical hierarchy for Poland. But we can't say that, for example, the conquests in Mazovia, that Mazovians straight away accepted Christianity. Very difficult to say.
I think we should throw that theory in here. I think it's the ideal point. So there is another theory about the Polish conversion to Christianity, and that it was actually Bolesław who converted Poland to Christianity and not Mieszko. What do you think?
How does this theory supposed to work?
I don't know. You've got to tell me. Help me out here.
Because this is a very interesting suggestion. I don't know. I never kind of entertained the idea that it was Bolesław who was there, the person that was converting the Poles to Christianity. I always looked through the eyes of those early Polish annals and chroniclers that placed firmly and squarely Christianization of the Poles as initiated by Mieszko. So can't really discuss this theory, not one that I'm very familiar with, I would say.
I'd say, to be honest, it is a bit of a far-fetched theory, because it was something that came up, funny enough, when I was doing a bit more research. And it was like, it was actually Bolesław who converted Poland to Christianity. I was like, really? Okay, when was this supposed to happen? So what, we're throwing this back a couple of like 20, 30, 40 years and we're completely off.
Interesting, because we can't deny that the information given to us in the sources is the only one that we can really rely on. And that information is that Dobrava arrives in 965, that Mieszko accepts baptism in 966, and Bolesław is born in 967. So Christianity is already there. The first mission from the West with Bishop Jordan arrives in Poznań, also around that early days, and Christianization begins. Perhaps even you can claim that is Dobrava who supposed to receive more credit for Christianization of Poland than anyone else.
So let's throw this theory out of the window. Gone now.
Yep, let's do it. Defenestration of theory, yes.
Totally gone. Okay, we've already brought up the Germans once, twice, maybe three times. We're now going to bring up the Germans one more time.
Yep.
Talk to us about his relationship with the Germans at the time.
With Bolesław? Bolesław and Germans.
Yes, Bolesław, not Mieszko and Germans, but Bolesław and Germans.
It is an interesting relationship because I suspect Mieszko, because of his military prowess, because of his military potential, is able to reach out and settle disputes in neighboring countries. By going west, he's, of course, stepping on German toes because the territory between his realm at that time and the marches of Saxony, for example, and Meissen, they are encroaching on Slavic lands. Because, you know, we used to look at Germany and we look at Germany and Berlin and that whole area there, the East Germany, and we kind of say, okay, Germany. But back then, in the 10th century, there is no Germany in that place. It is the confederation of Slavic tribes around the Slavic Brani border, for example. That's the town before Berlin was established there. In those marches that are established by the Germans, there's very much a fight between Lusitians and Germans, and then Poles as well. It's quite a strange relationship, you would say. Because by Germans recognize that Bolesław I is in fact a ruler that can use armed forces efficiently, and because of those powerful armies, he's able to face the German armies in the open field, and he's able to win on numerous occasions. So that early relationship after Bolesław comes to the throne in 992. That early relationship is interesting because it brings in the power of the emperor. Otto III, when he ascends the throne, he's very much interested in what's happening, in what is this Poland. I think he's curious. His friend, Adalbert of Prague, the missionary that we already mentioned, when he dies, this is the point at which Otto III decides that he will travel to meet with Bolesław, and he will travel to Poland and to see what this new realm in the north, the realm that just appeared on Christian map, what is this all about? I think that relationship at this point changes. The emperor is recognizing Bolesław's right to the crown. Bolesław is, according to those early chroniclers, one of those meetings, he takes his own crown off his head and places it on Bolesław's head. So there is an interesting, if not friendship, there is a recognition of the power and, you know, political and economic value of relationship with that Polish ruler. After Otto dies, a relationship between Bolesław and the next emperor, Henry, it deteriorates. So by 1025, for about 20 years, Bolesław is trying to get the crown approved by the Pope, and German emperor is very keen on preventing him from doing this. So definitely that relationship after death of Otto III deteriorates, and Poles and Germans enter this stage of history where they are seen to be enemies on both sides. Germans are looking at the Poles with suspicion, and the Poles are looking at Germans as invaders.
I've got to say, I mean, this early, very early relationship with Otto, I think Emperor Otto was really positive to hear that there was something good between the two nations, and then it just deteriorates. And I'm assuming that's where our, I don't even know how to describe it, our enemies, or how we just don't look at each other in a positive way anymore from that moment. And it's lasted through to, well, even today.
Well, I think that today it's another myth, you know, it's another myth that Germans were always enemies of the Poles, because there were times when the Poles were relatively in good relationship. If you think about the wives of the Jagiellon dynasty later on, Elżbieta Habsburżanka, she comes from imperial German house, after all. If you look at other wives of Sigmund II, August, Elżbieta, again, another of the Habsburg daughters, so Elizabeth Habsburg and then Catherine Habsburg. You've got other Habsburg wives in later kings. So very often those queens bring a certain relationship, detente in terms of it becomes a slightly different relationship. But I think it's a bit of a myth of history that Germans and Poles were enemies for the last 1,000 years. I think we can't generalize that widely.
So instead of saying more of a straight line kind of relationship, it was an up and down relationship rather than something so straightforward as saying we were just enemies.
Oh, I totally agree. Yes. And I would see it that way. I would say that at the time of Otto III, there was a chance of seeing of inclusion of Poland into that Europe, into that united, new, bright Europe. And I don't know if you've seen that image of from one of the very richly decorated manuscripts, which shows four women and bowing down in homage to Otto III, and to four women bringing gifts representing traditionally Roma, so Italy, the power of Italy, Gallia, so the Frankish realms, Germania, so Germany, and then Slovenia, personification of the Slavs. Those four women, personification of those parts of the Christian Universal Empire, pay homage to the emperor seated on the imperial throne. This is quite an interesting vision. So if you look at Europe from that point of view, that kind of permanent enemy situation for 1,000 years doesn't really work. I think I agree with you. It's very much up and down kind of relationship.
I love this. I've really got to tell you, this is a fantastic podcast, and I am learning so much that I didn't even know that. For me, actually, this is becoming really important for my own research and my own understanding of the Polish nation, where it started. And I'm definitely going to be ranting and raving about this for the next 6 months. So let's move on to the end, because we're coming towards the end. Bolesław actually becomes king of Poland. I mean, obviously he's a duke, kind of however you want to describe it at this point. He is not a king, but he becomes king. How does this happen?
That is a, I, my kind of, my vision of this past is that Poles perhaps didn't really care about the crown. That crown became something very accidental, and became something that they observe was important in the West. And they looked at those Latin phrases like rex and dux, you know, king and duke. And that became important because of that cultural transfer that was happening at the time. In order to be seen as equal to the emperors, to the great emperors of the past, you need to have a crown. You need to have your laurel leaf wreath on your head. And when Otto III does this ceremonial, you would say, crowning of Bolesław the Brave at the Congress of Gniezno, that perhaps gives Bolesław the idea that recognition by the emperor of this supreme status among the Slavic rulers of Boleslav, that this needs to be formalized also by the Pope. And we understand that early death of Otto III prevented crowning, receiving the crown by Boleslav himself, and that Boleslav was very much working towards receiving the crown consecrated by the Pope for quite some time. Emperor Henry II in essentially prevented this happening. And it's the coronation is a bit of a tricky thing. There is a brilliant picture of picture painting made by Jan Matejko, a famous Polish painter of the 19th century, where Bolesław is being crowned, and Bolesław receives crown with the blessing of the emperor, which we know is a bit of a work of fiction, because what happens in 1024, Emperor Henry II dies. At this point, Bolesław takes advantage of the instability of German throne itself and crowns himself. We know that Western chroniclers, including those that very much were siding with the next emperor, with Conrad II, are commenting that Bolesław, the Slavic ruler, the Duke of the Poles, he takes the crown for himself without any regard to the power of the emperor, that he usurps insignia of the king, and he takes the royal name without agreement of the emperor. Look, we don't actually know exactly how it happened. Bolesław is crowned, perhaps at Easter, perhaps at Christmas. We don't know the exact time of his coronation. And I think the assumption is, and there are different historians that suggest different things. I know that Tadeusz Wojciechowski years ago suggested it was Christmas Day. Other historians look at Easter time. He is crowned. He's crowned in his own land. He is crowned with the crown that becomes legendary. This is the first coronation insignia of Poland. This is the first time that, in the eyes of Western Christianity, Poland received the crown, permission from Pope. And this is Pope John the 19th. Who at the time sanctioned that coronation by local bishops. And in theory, could Emperor Conrad prevented this coronation? Perhaps yes, perhaps not. We know that, and this is some of the German chroniclers at the time being kind of outraged with this coronation, leave the comment at the end in their accounts of it. Look, the crown didn't really fit his head for long because he soon died. We know that he dies perhaps in June after his coronation. So if the coronation took place on Christmas Day, then he leaves another 6 months and dies.
This is not the end. I mean, we are going to be continuing talking about, obviously, the Piast dynasty with kings and dukes and things that are falling apart in Poland, because it's not quite as straightforward, is it, that it just goes from king to king to king next, is it?
Of course it's not, because we're going to have also Polish pagans will raise up very soon after this coronation, and they will say, no, we don't want Christianity, we don't want Christian churches, we want to destroy all of those outrageous symbols of foreign religion, and this pagan reaction will take over and destroy majority of the things that Piast dynasty built.
Right. We're going to save this for podcast number two. So do come back, because part two, we're going to be talking about Mieszko II and Kazimierz Odnowiciel, who in English, if I'm not wrong, it's Kazimierz the Restorer.
Yes, very much so.
I'm really excited because we're going to be talking about lots of uprisings and things that basically go wrong. So do stay tuned. Dariusz, thank you so much for joining us, because this is excellent. I have learned so much that I am going to go away today buzzing and go onto Twitter and just bombard everybody with some really cool. Actually, I'm not going to give it all away, but I'm going to give it away that we're doing talking about some really cool stuff about Polish history. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you and talking about Piast Dynasty. And I'm looking forward to our next installment.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there and we have our own channel and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.